It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, lawmakers voted to close the state's Lincoln Hills Juvenile Detention Center 4 years ago. So why is it still open today? We'll talk about that and how the process is affecting resource-strapped communities across Wisconsin. But first, a recent survey by the nonprofit research organization Common Sense Media found that social media use and screen time among children and teens is increasing. It's rising at a faster rate in recent years. Children as young as 8 reported spending more time on apps like TikTok, Snapchat, and YouTube. This despite the apps requiring users to be at least 13 years old to create an account. This raises questions about what children and teens are being exposed to and how it affects them and us. We want to know what you think. We're at 1-800-642-1234. How much social media do you let your kids use? What rules do you set on their screen time? What works? 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Our guest today is Jean Twenge, psychology professor at San Diego State University. She's author of the book iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and what that means for the rest of us. Jean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much.
Well, I'm glad you could join us. You know, not all social media platforms work the same way. So I'm wondering, when you look at the research, how you draw the distinction between, you know, your Instagram, where users are posting, versus Snapchat, where they're messaging?
Yeah, so there are a lot of differences between these platforms. So Instagram tends to be much more curated. It's mostly about posting photos and getting likes and followers. And it's also often used for people to follow influencers. So it can extend, you know, far beyond the friend group, especially on the Explore page. And then Snapchat is photos that can disappear. So it's more often used for one-on-one communication, but because the photos disappear, it's also often used to circumvent adults seeing what kids are doing. So thus, kids and teens tend to use it for stuff that adults wish they wouldn't do.
Right.
And then TikTok is new to the realm after about 2 years ago, became very, very popular. And it's mostly known for short videos of people dancing, but it's now used for all kinds of communication.
So how are different age groups affected differently by screen time and by social media use?
Well, you know, I think there's the most concern, and rightly so, for younger kids who are using social media. So as you mentioned in your introduction, kids are supposed to be 13 before they have a social media account in their own name. That's from a 1998 law called COPPA. But the problem is that that's not enforced. Nobody asks for your ID. They don't even ask for a parent to verify anything. The apps vary, but in many cases, you don't even have to give a birthday. Some you do, but then kids are pretty adept at being able to figure out that just changing the year works, and then they can get in, or they can check the box that says I'm 13. It's extremely easy to circumvent that age minimum. And so that's the concern, because these apps were not designed for children. I mean, they really weren't even designed for teens. They were designed for adults. And thus, there's big problems with that, both in terms of the content that kids and teens are exposed to, as well as how difficult it is to log out and to put them down. And they're specifically designed that way because that's how the companies make money.
So why did we agree on age 13 as a cutoff?
There was no developmental reason for that. I don't even know the history of why they agreed on 13. And it really doesn't make a lot of sense. That's kind of right in that middle school time, which is already very fraught socially and emotionally. I and many other experts think that it should be at least 16, and you could make arguments for it being 18.
So what are some of the negative impacts that you have seen in your research?
So I think the most concerning piece is the trends in mental health. So, I came to this question around technology kind of from a different angle. My career has mostly looked at generational differences, how when you were born influences your personality traits, your behavior, your attitudes. So that's what I write about in iGen. That's my book about Gen Z. And what I noticed very quickly in looking at this group born 1995 and later was they were very unhappy compared to the millennial teens just before them. Much less satisfied with their lives, considerably lower in self-confidence and self-esteem, and more likely to say, I feel like I can't do anything right, or that my life isn't useful, or that I don't enjoy life. And those are classic symptoms of depression. Big national government-sponsored surveys have looked at this too. So clinical-level depression doubled among teens between 2011 and 2019. And notice that's even before the pandemic was entered into the mix.
Sure.
Also, self-harm increased. Suicide rates increased. And this all happened right at the time that social media use moved from optional to mandatory among teens. Because it's, of course, there's a problem with individuals, say, spending too much time on social media and that having potential impacts on their mental health. But it goes beyond that, because the way that kids socialize with each other has been completely changed. The norm is no longer to get with your friends face to face. It's to communicate online through Instagram and Snapchat and TikTok. So even if you have a kid who doesn't really want to use social media, they're going to be left out. And who are they going to hang out with? They can't pretend that it's 1988. They're not going to have people to hang out with in person because that's no longer the norm.
So how do you trace and pinpoint the effects of social media specifically? Because so many other things happened in our world. I mean, they've lived through the Great Recession. Born witness to so many tragedies that have gone on in the world. How do you draw the line back to social media?
Well, it's a multi-step process. So the first is to look at timing. So the Great Recession is a very good example. Teen depression began to increase around 2012 and continued in that direction. So started its increase and then kept going. Economic factors related to the Great Recession go in exactly the opposite direction. The Great Recession officially was between about 2007 and 2009. Unemployment peaked in 2010. So that period from 2012 to 2019, when teen depression increases, the economy was getting better. Unemployment was going down. We had economic growth. So it's actually completely mismatched with economic factors. And then in terms of other events, it's very difficult to think of anything else that started around 2012 and then reverberated through the next 8 years or increased in its influence. There's not a whole lot that falls in that category. The other thing is, when you're speaking of news events, those are things that people read about. They sure can have an impact on those who directly experience them, but they don't have as much impact on day-to-day life. It's extremely difficult to think of anything else other than smartphones and social media and technology writ large that had such a big influence on teens' day-to-day lives. It completely changed how they spent their time outside of school.
Well, I want to go to the phones now because, Jean, we've got a caller coming in for you. We've got Eric in Delafield on the line that wants to join the conversation. Good afternoon, Eric.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I think this is a terrific topic, and thank you for bringing it to us listeners. And your guest's last words were something to the effect of time spent away from school. And I just wanted to touch make a point here and touch base. And so I'm an executive director of a boys summer camp called Red Arrow Camp in northern Wisconsin. And our focus is a residential experience that's 7 weeks long, unplugged, log cabin living, sports, adventure, wilderness, all of those things. And I'm not trying to plug our camp necessarily, but I'm coming with the notion that parents are looking for alternatives. I'm a parent myself, to combat this dependence on screens. And I hear it more and more with interest from families looking for an experience where boys can really truly step away from that, disconnect to better connect with themselves and socially and others that they get to know at camp. And it's heartwarming. And I think parents need to realize there's opportunities out there like that.
Eric, I'm so curious, if I may, do you allow screens and phones for?
Absolutely not. 7 weeks, it's unplugged. And you say, you know, how can we do that? And we have such a curriculum of fun activities and growth experiences and classes and wilderness trips and there are no screens. In fact, it's letter writing home to mom and dad. And we have to teach boys how to address Wow. envelopes and write old, you know, handwritten letters and things. And so, you know, parents can visit, you know, on specific days, but it's quite refreshing. And these boys really transform and grow and find themselves new ways of resilience and friendship and build meaningful relationships. They live in log cabins together. It's fantastic, you know, and so I just promote that kind of thing, whether it's, you know, any kind of camp experience is sure. great, but there are camps like ours out there. We're just north of Minocqua, sure. Wisconsin. We've been around 100 years, but I think it's terrific, and we should really embrace these opportunities because it is thanks. A problem and parents are seeing it.
Yeah, so thanks, Eric. So interesting. I'm glad you bring this up, and I want to bring this to Jean. Jean, have you in your research and your conversations with parents and your look at the data, have you seen this trend of parents wanting help, wanting ideas for alternatives?
Absolutely. So I have three kids myself. They're ages 10, 12, and 15. So I see this all the time in my own house, too. Kids even get laptops for school. So even if you have parental controls on other devices, you cannot put parental controls on that school laptop. So during the school year, a lot of parents are very, very stuck with how to try to manage their kids' use of devices. So summer is a great opportunity. Camps are a wonderful opportunity, whether that's sleepaway camp or day camps that don't allow devices, because then kids and teens can have that chance to learn who they are aside from the screen, can learn how to relate to people face to face, build those social skills that they will need for their careers, and gain that attention span that they're going to need yeah. as well. Because they're not getting that during the school year. Most schools sure. allow phones during the school day. Any teacher will tell you how distracting that is. Then the kids have the phone at lunch, and then they're not talking to each other face-to-face during lunch period either. What I find really fascinating when I have visited schools is how many teens are interested in a device-free experience, whether that's camp or international travel. There are some programs take the phones away because it's too hard to set up an international data plan. And at first, it's like withdrawal. But yeah. then they really like it. I have heard that over and over from people who organize types of programs.
Interesting. Well, we'll pick that up in a moment. We're speaking about social media use among children with San Diego State University psychology professor Jean Twenge. You can join us 1-800-642-1234. Do you think social media is harmful to children? Whose responsibility is it to protect children from the apps? Should it be the government? What role do parents play? 1-800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. We're talking to San Diego State University psychology professor Jean Twenge about how social media use and screen time affects children and teens. Would love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. In what ways do you think children are being affected by social media and screen time? How is this different from previous generations growing up on TV? 1-800-642-1234. Well, Gene, I want to ask you about what can be done about regulation. And in the State of the Union address earlier this month, President Biden called out social media companies, called for greater protection for young users.
Children were also struggling before the pandemic, bullying, violence, trauma, and the harms of social media. As Frances Haugen, who is here tonight with us, has shown, we must hold social media platforms accountable for the national experiment they're conducting on our children for profit.
So that was President Biden speaking there, referencing Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower who leaked company research showing that some teen girls' mental health got worse after they used Instagram. And I wonder what you think should be done. What type of steps could help make social media less harmful?
Yeah, it's one of the few things where there's bipartisan agreement. And we saw that during the congressional hearings in the fall when Frances Haugen testified. Both Democrats and Republicans agreed that we need more regulation of social media, particularly for children. So enforcing that age minimum of 13 is one way to do that. And then for, say, 13 to 17-year-olds or 13 to 15-year-olds, have a experience for them on social media that is not necessarily the same as for adults. Because if you talk to teens, you know, what they like about Instagram is keeping up with their friends. What they tend not to like is how scrolling through the pages of influencers and looking at the explore page exposes them to things that make them feel bad about themselves. And that's what Facebook's internal research showed, which is consistent with the academic research as well, that a lot, especially of teen girls, say that spending a lot of time on Instagram that leads to what they called in the internal research a grief spiral, where they feel bad about themselves and they end up feeling depressed and bad about their body. So there's these impacts on body image. And in the academic research, what we find is people who spend 5 or more hours a day on social media are about twice as likely to have clinically significant depression compared to those who either don't use social media or only use it less than an hour a day. And those effects tend to be stronger for girls than for boys.
So I'm wondering, do you think that's because, as you say, the apps are designed for adults, and so you have kids and teens consuming media that wasn't designed for them? Would it be better if social media actually developed age-specific content and apps, or would that not help?
Well, perhaps for those over the age of 13. But that's not where they have put their attention. So Instagram, for example, wanted to develop an Instagram for kids, for 8 to 12-year-olds. But that strikes me and many others as a spectacularly bad idea. I mean, you just think about Instagram in particular. It, at base, is an app where people post pictures of themselves and invite criticism and comment. It just isn't really what we want 8 to 12-year-olds to be doing. Yeah. Because there are other ways for kids that age, and even 13 to 17-year-olds, even adults, to communicate with each other. You know, they can text, they can use FaceTime. So, you know, I think that's another thing for parents to keep in mind, that yes, of course, kids want to be on social media to communicate with their friends, but there's lots of other ways that they can communicate with their friends without having to be on social media.
Yes, and I want to go to a call now coming in from Eau Claire. We've got Adam on the line with a question for you, Gene. Good afternoon, Adam. What's on your mind?
Hey, I don't actually have a question. I just wanted to kind of share my perspective. I'm 36, but, you know, so as a kid, I didn't have a phone in high school, but I played a lot of video games on the computer, and my parents limited that. And, you know, once I got to college, I kind of increased that screen time and played more games and became, you know, more isolated, I guess. And I really found that I struggled communicating effectively with my peers and with my professors. And so I kind of had a bit of self-awareness and stepped back and kind of reduced my screen time intentionally and started paying attention to, you know, my rhetoric, how I spoke, how I wrote, my body language, and just how I I made a concerted effort to engage with my peers a little bit more. And it really changed a lot in how I, traveled through the world, and it opened a lot of doors.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam, for sharing that. And I wonder, Gene, what advice you would give parents for developing healthy screen habits?
So a couple years ago, I was visiting a college campus and sat in on a class where they were discussing media. And so we discussed some of these issues. It was mostly college freshmen and sophomores. And they went around the room and talked about what their parents had done in terms of limiting screen time. And about half or so said that their parents severely limited screen time. And every single one of those young people said that they were happy that their parents had done that. And I thought that was really fascinating. They said then, you know, because their screen time was limited, they had to see people face to face. They had to read. They had to find other ways to occupy your time. And you know, I think as parents, this is what we have to think about. You know, our kids are living in a world where technology is everywhere. I have heard some people suggest that means we should just give up and you know, let people use the technology because it is everywhere and use it as much as they want.
Sure.
But it really is about limits. It's about moderation. So the kids want to play games, but only for a few hours. Then they have to go do something else.
Well, Gene, we will have to leave it there. We are up against the clock. But thank you so much for joining us today. Gene Twenge is a psychology professor at San Diego State University. She is the author of the book, iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz. Coming up, we learn more about the origins of the term cancel culture and how it fits in with our ideals of accountability and free speech. Now, state lawmakers voted to close the Lincoln Hill and Copper Lake Juvenile Detention Center 4 years ago. That came after years of allegations of abuse and violent interactions between guards and inmates. But despite that, both facilities remain open today. And according to new reporting from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, some judges, left with few other options, are being forced to continue to send young people there. We're talking about what's driving that delay to close Lincoln Hills and how that's impacting our local justice systems across the state. We'd love to hear from you. Do you want to see Lincoln Hills closed down once and for all? What changes do you want to see in how the state approaches juvenile justice? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas@WPR.org. We have with us Sarah Volpenheim, Report for America reporter covering underserved communities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Molly. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could join us. Well, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, they were supposed to close almost 10 months ago. What's kept that from happening?
Yeah, they were supposed to close by law by July 1st of last year. And it's likely that they won't close for years to come. And that's because the replacement facilities that lawmakers envisioned would be built to replace Lincoln Hills have not been built. That's been because of a range of setbacks having to do with underfunding, disputes over where to actually put the facilities and other setbacks. Recently, though, within the last couple of months, state lawmakers did finally pass a bill to fund the construction of a new state-run juvenile correctional facility in Milwaukee County. The governor is expected to sign that in the next couple of weeks, and that should at least get this process going in a, you know, in a more positive direction, and put in motion the actual closure that's been really delayed and stalled for the last several years.
Yeah, but so in the meantime, we still have judges that need to do something. They're looking for facilities to send youth that are in the system that need some kind of rehabilitation. What are the options?
Yeah, it's true. Judges don't have a lot of options for the kids who have the most needs, the ones who have committed, you know, more serious offenses.
Hey, Ken, it sounds like we're having some technical issues.
Really,
for some reason,
they try to email you
a link where you can listen
like they
to
have
the
to as a last
live.
Resort.
It's got a little bit of a delay.
If nothing else is working.
Sarah's portion of the interview, too.
They
so
have
stand by
for
that.
Kids that they decide need a secure or a locked setting are Lincoln Hills or Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center, which is in Madison, or at least in Milwaukee County, there's also a county-run program that's seen as an alternative to Lincoln Hills. The first half of it takes place in detention, but then the kids transition back into the community for the second half. And that is kind of like the step down from Lincoln Hills. It's like the next most serious placement that a judge might choose for one of the more high needs kids that they're seeing. But the problem is there's sending kids to Lincoln Hills is kind of a legal gray zone. There's been some uncertainty about whether it's even legal to send certain kids there. But at the end of the day, you know, judges have relied on this workaround to still try to send some kids there.
Right. So there was this plan to develop these regional centers that were provide alternatives to this one, you know, these two centralized state facilities. And as you mentioned, they have not come to pass yet. So is there enough capacity on the local level for programs to help young people?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we found in our reporting was that the local options are very overwhelmed right now. They're under a lot of pressure. That county-run program that I mentioned for more serious offenders or kids with the highest needs, the one that's the step down from Lincoln Hills, that one has a waiting list. Kids can be on this waiting list for months. In my reporting, found a 16-year-old kid who has been on the waiting list for 2 months. He's just sitting in detention waiting for a spot to open up in this program. And while he's on this wait list, he's not getting the services that he would get as a part of that program. And he's not able to avail himself of those tools to, you know, get treatment and get back on the right track.
So in the meantime, where are these kids? These kids are being held in local jails?
Yeah, some of them are basically what's happening is judges are relying more heavily on this county-run program, which is called MCAP, the Milwaukee County Accountability Program. So they're telling them to wait in the county detention center until a spot opens up in that program. But they're also still sending some kids to Lincoln Hills. They're not allowed under the law to close Lincoln Hills, to send kids directly to Lincoln Hills at disposition, which is the juvenile equivalent of a sentencing. But judges have kind of relied on this workaround, which is in this kind of legal gray zone where they sentence a kid. Prosecutors file what's called a change in placement, which asks the judge to reconsider their sentence and to commit the kid to Lincoln Hills. And then normally the judge will hold another hearing, hear the arguments, and then make a decision on that request. So kids are still getting sent to Lincoln Hills, even though technically it was supposed to have closed last year.
And do we know how many kids are there currently?
For Milwaukee County, it's somewhere between 30 and 40 young people that are there currently that the county is responsible for paying for. There's also additional Milwaukee County youth there who are there on what are called serious juvenile offender cases, which the state is responsible for paying for them. I'm not totally sure how many there are of that, but it's safe to say there's dozens of youth from Milwaukee County at Lincoln Hills right now.
So what's currently on the table as far as solutions for this situation?
Yeah, really what I hear from judges and from attorneys is that we need more local options. And, you know, part of what they're calling for is the county-run and state-run juvenile facilities that have not been built, even though they were supposed to have been by this point. As we've talked about, the state-run facility is, you know, we're seeing some progress on building the state-run juvenile facility in the county, but there's also attorneys and the judges calling for county-run facilities or for more local programming, especially advocates who are very involved with youth justice issues want to see more local programming that addresses the needs of kids outside of a correctional setting in more of a less restrictive setting. So there's calls for that as well.
Well, we will continue to follow your reporting and the reporting of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on this issue. Thank you so much for being with us today, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sarah Volpenheim is the Report for America reporter covering underserved communities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Up next, we'll hear from someone who's studied juvenile justice for decades about where the movement to close Lincoln Hills started and what it would take to make that a reality. Would love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. What would a better juvenile justice system look like? We'll continue this conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're looking at the ongoing efforts to close Lincoln Hills. We'd love to hear from you, maybe your own experiences with the state's juvenile justice system. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@wpr.org. Ken Streit joins us now. He's a retired clinical professor of law at UW-Madison who studied criminal justice and juvenile justice for decades. Ken, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So you've studied criminal justice for such a long time. From your perspective, why has closing this facility been so hard to do?
Well, let me just go back. So, I mean, I hate to be too old, but about 40 years ago,
I didn't mean it that way.
But about 40 years ago, in the early 80s, the state changed its way of running state juvenile institutions. And so instead of providing quote unquote free placements for the kids, they took the $30 million that they were spending on the two institutions and gave that to the counties. And then said to the counties, if you can find something, a better way to handle it, use this money. If you need to send them to the kid there, to the state institutions, we're going to charge you. And the cost back then was about $2,000 a month, about $25,000 a year. At that point, immediately, some counties who were probably not really needing to send their kids at all before immediately stopped and used their resources to build their programs. And over 40 years, those have sort of continued to develop so that by the early 2000s, they were at the point that they didn't really have enough kids to justify two institutions. So back in the early 80s, there were like 1,200 kids. By the early 2000s, there were about 600 kids. But what happens is it becomes more costly every year, or as the number of kids in the institutions go down, the per diems go up. So right now it's about $400,000 per kid. There's about 50 kids at Lincoln Hills right now.
And how much did you say?
What happened?
Ken, how much did you say?
400,000.
400,000?
400,000 a year. Yeah. So, but what happened was all that time, it was basically county-led deinstitutionalization, county-led community programs. Increasingly, counties such as Racine is a good example, realized that having the kid in the community and then having the local public school be the school teachers for the kids there and having the parents around turned out to be not only cheaper, but turned out to be far more effective as far as reintegrating the kids into the program. So that's how, excuse me, increasingly counties develop the capacity to take care of a lot of the kids. And I'm just going to be a little generalizing. So the first 90% of the kids were relatively easy to program back into the community. Right now, we're at about 5% of what the level was 40 years ago. And those are really challenging kids. So an example is Milwaukee, for example, has 40 kids in a unit that's basically a six-month program. There's a lot of kids who can do 6 months in a rehabilitation, high education, high achieving kind of program. Now, they can do that maybe standing on their heads when they're in the program. No guarantees that that's necessarily going to be effective later on, but they can very well comply with those kind of expectations. Then there are kids that just don't do that well in those programs. And so then the challenge, and my guess would be a lot of the kids who are at Lincoln Hills are kids who have a whole variety of reasons why they can't be in the program. In addition to the 40, 50 kids there at Lincoln Hills, there's also about 30 kids at Mendota Mental Health Center. And those are kids with even more serious mental health challenges. A lot of them are kids who respond inversely to typical kind of discipline. So when they're disciplined for bad behavior, they just follow up with more bad behavior and all that. Mm-hmm. So the kids at Lincoln Hills are sort of in between that group. And what happened was that 4 years ago when they decided to close the facility, I think they just didn't understand that you needed to have some clear direction of who was going to be responsible for developing the programs for that last 5% of the kids. Again, you know, it always had been developed by local leadership. And the difference was that like in Racine County, they were already had budgeted. They knew that they needed a new program. So the funding that was available for Racine was, I don't want to say it was a gift to Racine, but they knew they were going in that direction anywhere. And so the amount of money that the state gave out 4 years ago was plenty for Racine County. On the other hand, Milwaukee was sort of flat-footed. They had not really done that. And so I think there was a lot of sort of walking side by side with the county looking at the state saying, are you going to take the lead? And the state saying, boy, we're really bad at citing correctional facilities in counties. Would you take the lead?
Right.
And so nobody really clearly had the responsibility. And the legislation sort of provided opportunities, but it didn't provide expectations. And so when both of them, the county sort of passed because when they looked at what they would have to build and what it was going to cost them, the amount of money that was available in the original legislation just wasn't nearly enough. And then I think probably right now I heard the reporter saying, I mean, I think the state is wanting to do this one program with a, what's currently a minimum security facility, which means for adult men, which is a pre-release, guys who have been in prison for a long time so they can get jobs and things like that.
I see that we have a caller on the line, and I want to invite her into the conversation to join us and hear what you think about her comments. So we've got Allison on the line in Stevens Point.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Hi. Yes. What's your thought or question for Ken?
Yeah. I really appreciate this conversation, and I think we need to be having more of these. So often, though, they have such limiting parameters where we're not able to think, you know, a step beyond, you know, what's good for these kids. And ultimately, they're kids, and we forget about that. We call them inmates. And really, like, we can all agree that what the ideal juvenile justice system looks like is one that basically doesn't exist. Like we can all agree that we don't want to punish kids. That's not something that we strive to do. And so, you know, when we talk about shifting money from this pot to that pot, we ultimately, like, are so stuck within the parameters of what's been done before that, you know, we forget things that are just tried and true facts, like prevention dollars go 10 times farther than treatment/punishment dollars, like the fact that basic childhood development understandings tell us that kids in cages away from the people who love and care about them the most, even if those people, you know, are in situations that are pretty dysfunctional, ultimately is not a way to heal a child or anybody else.
Got it. Allison, got it. I want to hear Ken's response. We've got just a few moments left. Ken.
Okay.
Alternative.
So I think I think the difficulty with, let's just, like I said before, the 40-day program that Milwaukee and Racine and a variety of other counties are doing, it meets the needs of a wide range of kids. It's not inexpensive. And each of those kids, those are cookie cutter kids. They sort of are able to bring together enough staffing. You need sort of a critical mass of population before you can afford to have enough of the different variety of specialists that you need to respond to kids. That last 5% really then becomes a much, their needs are even more wide ranging. I would disagree. I would never call the kids inmates. I would never call these prisons. They are insecure kind of facilities, but the approach is very much a treatment and rehabilitation approach. One of the things that they found out with Lincoln Hills is that they were sort of staffed at an 11-to-1 ratio. They realized that they really needed to be staffed at about a 6-to-1 ratio in order to have the positive effects that they were needing to have. Now, that's a very intense ratio compared to a lot of other programs, but they at least realized that. So I think they are really investing and trying to make the kids healthier. It's not putting them in cages, although it's incidental that it's a secure facility. And I think because those needs are so intense and so wide ranging, you really do need to gather a lot of people and be very intentional about the facility that you're going to need to have, because it doesn't look like a facility that you've thought about before for kids who are high school age kids.
Well, Ken, we've got just a few seconds left. What's the thing you're watching for next with this?
Well, I think what they really need to do, what the legislators have to do, is, if they haven't been told this before, to recognize that historically this has been a grassroots kind of thing which had no state mandate. I think between the legislature and the governor, they have to point a single leader to develop the programs.
Someone
to make this happen.
Has to take
Otherwise,
responsibility.
It's not going to happen.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Gotcha, Ken. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking to Ken Street, retired clinical professor of law at UW-Madison, talking about the effort to close the Lincoln Hills, Copper Lake Juvenile Detention Centers. Coming up on the morning show, Lee Rayburn talks with three neighborhood leaders in Milwaukee about what they're doing to strengthen their community. The program works block by block to improve the quality of life for residents. You can learn all about it tomorrow morning after 7 on the morning show. Heads up, here's something you could do tonight instead of, well, sleeping. You could head outside in search of the Northern Lights. Satellites have detected a geomagnetic storm, which means that you just might get to see the magical colors of an aurora borealis. They typically show up as green or magenta, and they happen when charged particles from the sun collide with atmospheric gases in Earth's magnetic field. The National Weather Service says that the best place to see them in Wisconsin is west of Madison, but, you know, it might be cloudy until around 3 a.m. or so. Western Wisconsin might do better. The sky's expected to be clear around Black River Falls and Eau Claire around 10. And hey, if you do see them, send us a photo. We're at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Molly Stentz. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.